everybody. Today we have a really interesting show. It's a huge backlog of a lot of questions that I have been not getting to like I should, so apologize about that. So we're just going to run through a ton of questions today about a whole bunch of different stuff. I think it's going to be kind of interesting. I think a lot of you will get a ton out of this just to see just the variety of things that our listeners have to face with their student loans. So we'll try to get through as many questions as we can. And, you know, if any of them sound like they don't apply to you, just use that like fast forward button on your podcast player. So let's start with the first one about an American living abroad.
Hey there. I'm an American abroad, and I recently applied to consolidate my FFEL loans and Perkins loans through Aidvantage. I already have loans through Aidvantage, so I was calling them about something else yesterday. And during that call, I found out that they sent the letter that has the 10-day window to respond or make any changes to the consolidation. They told me that that letter has been sent 5 days ago, so 6 days now. They asked me if I had that letter in front of me, and since I'm abroad, it's unlikely that I'm going to receive that letter in time within that 10-day window to respond. So I'm concerned about what that letter contains and what would happen if I'm not able to respond within the time, if I wanted to make any changes, for example, or if I wanted to cancel the application, or just in general, I'm concerned about not receiving the information in time. So I'm wondering what other Americans abroad do. Do they face this situation? What's the legality of that? What are my options? Is there anyone that I could call to have the letter read to me, for example, if they can send it through the platform? The person at the representative at Aidvantage wasn't able to give me that information at all. So I'm just a little concerned about the situation and curious about your advice. Thank you so much.
So it's a pretty common issue, really. I mean, just in general, for people living abroad, it's pretty challenging to do anything with your servicer. I mean, the big thing that we like to tell people living abroad is most people don't know about the foreign earned income exclusion. That is where you can earn, I think it's up to like 120 or 130K that you can earn abroad and file your tax return in the US and basically have a $0 AGI in the US. So that's really intended so that middle-class people that go abroad and work a little bit abroad, make some money, don't have to go with the nuisance of like hiring a tax professional with expat skills that can, you know, handle filing in both places. What that means functionally is we got a lot of people that will move to like Australia or Europe and they'll have student loans and they can file a tax return. And basically every year they file in the US, get a $0 income because this foreign earned income exclusion and pay $0 on their IDR plan. And instead of being in default, they're getting, you know, 100% of their interest subsidized. It's wonderful. I know that doesn't answer this particular borrower's question. Unfortunately, I think that this person's just out of luck. You know, it's kind of difficult to handle servicer type communication when you're abroad. I mean, obviously they're operating with the assumption that everybody's in the US, so nothing really can do in this situation. Let's now go to the next one.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my question. I love the podcast and find it incredibly helpful. I am curious about something you mentioned in a previous episode. You referred to doctors and other providers who work for Kaiser Permanente getting PSLF credit even though they work for a private institution. While I didn't work for Kaiser Permanente, I did work for a private medical company as an outreach athletic trainer to a public school where I was both teaching and doing clinical hours with the athletics department. I worked there for several years, and it would actually give me a huge bump in my PSLF count if I could get credit for these. But when I go to the student aid website, it doesn't allow me to certify because I have to have a government official letter or something from the, what sounds like it has to be a government contract. Do you have any advice on how I could submit for this, or does that sound like something that would be covered under these new guidelines? I would love to get more credit if possible. Thank you for your help.
Sometimes things don't apply to folks, and this is an example of this not applying to this borrower, unfortunately. You know, you can only get PSLF credit if you are not working directly for a 501c3 or government employer, if your position is not allowed for you to be working for directly for that employer by state law. So that's really a very narrow definition. I think this is why they were able to get around the regulations on this, frankly. I think that this was a very smart campaign by the narrow group of people that were affected by this problem that successfully got the regulations rewritten for them. I think that they deliberately wrote the regulations pretty narrowly to avoid a lawsuit or a challenge from, like, you know, Republicans or something like that on this. So unfortunately, this listener could not get extra credit on PSLF. This is something, you know, that only applies to people that by state law could not work directly for their nonprofit or government employer, which is really mostly, you know, physicians and mostly in California, frankly. It seems like a lot of these other states that have these prohibitions have like softened them up a whole lot for direct physician employment. Unfortunately, this also means that, like, let's say you have a physician that worked at a place like Kaiser, like they can qualify for PSLF now. But let's say you have a support staff person that works for Kaiser, they're not prohibited by state law from getting PSLF. So unfortunately, that person would not qualify to get PSLF credit unless they're, sorry, employed directly by the nonprofit entity, right? So what I meant to say there is, just to be precise in my language, is if that person was employed by the, you know, for-profit group that was contracted with the 501c3, if they're not prohibited by state law from being directly employed by that nonprofit, then they can't qualify for PSLF. So a lot of nuance with all these new regulations. Now let's check out the next one.
Hey, so I'm going for double consolidation. I just had a question about some of the servicers servicing that. So I noticed AidVantage, they have the same address as Mohila and Ed Financial. I was wondering if there's any problem with sending to one of those servicers other than Nelnet, as they're all working under the same roof. I know AidVantage is handling the consolidations, so I was just wondering if there's any complications that you guys seen or anything like that. So thank you.
So I really love involving Nelnet and then anybody else in double consolidations and then sending it to either Nelnet or anybody else in that list. So the reason being is Nelnet's the only company that processes consolidations besides AidVantage. It used to be that every servicer processed their own consolidations. I think all the servicers were very eager to cut costs with all the complexity with student loans. And so AidVantage handles the consolidations for everybody. The way we've seen this pop up as a problem most frequently is AidVantage will often process the consolidation before the IDR application that was submitted with it. And so sometimes we see people get there or vice versa. So we'll see, for example, somebody complete a double consolidation that applied for, you know, the pay or the save plan, and they'll get denied because they'll say they have Parent Plus loans. And that's just because of the order in which AidVantage processed the consolidation. So what we tend to do for double consolidation folks these days is just tell them to submit for like the extended or the standard plan, even though it's a huge payment, and not to set up auto pay during that process. And so there's no consequences to having, you know, a couple months of non-payment, right? You know, the process is just trying to get through that double consolidation intact. And then you just, frankly, right now, it seems like people have no choice but to call the servicer, mention the double consolidation, and because the online website seems to be blocking people from getting onto the save and pay plans, probably because they wrote the logic like it's 2025 and it's not yet. The people who programmed the site did. So, you know, it's really weird, these nuanced double consolidation things. That's why, you know, a lot of our double consolidation clients, like, they'll book a consult and then they might book a follow-up consult just to kind of go over that with one of our paperwork Parent Plus specialists that's just really an expert in the process of reviewing things with folks. So definitely encourage anybody that could benefit from the Parent Plus double consolidation, if you can afford it, to book with our team. So now for the next one.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm an athletic trainer at a big high school in Illinois. I'm currently employed, though, through an outreach physical therapy company. So the physical therapy company is contracted by the school, and the physical therapy company then pays me to go work at the school. So unfortunately, I am not categorized as a school employee. I have about $44,000 in student debt, mostly from grad school. What avenues am I looking at in order to look at any kind of forgiveness? I've started my loans back in 2007. I've been paying since, but obviously I've had the student loan pause. Looking at, like I said, either the PSLF, if that's a possibility. Unfortunately, I have applied and was denied eligible employment through the company I work for. I am currently on the SAVE plan, just looking to see if there's any other avenues I should look into.
So without guessing too much about this listener's income, I mean, I guess I should just guess. So let's just say hypothetically this person makes $80,000. Let's say they're a family of four, pretty common arrangement in America, right? Let's say that this person's married to somebody that makes about the same income as him. So say you've got a dual income household, each making 80K. with two kids. What does that mean? What does that look like with saved payments? So if you have one person making 80, you file separate with two kids and a spouse, you're going to use family size of 3 because you exclude the spouse when you file separate with save. So deduction for a family of 3 is about $55,000. So if you take $80,000 minus $55,000, you're going to pay 10% on that remainder. So that's 10% on about $25,000. It's about $2,500 a year or about $200 a month. The cool part is you can get that number lower. And there's a lot of nuances with save that people are not yet aware of. So one is if you consolidate, they're going to use 10% no matter what, even if you have undergrad loans mixed in. On a moderate balance, like $44,000, it really depends on the setup of the loans. But you know, if everything's already direct, then you might not consolidate if you already have, if you have the same credit for everything. If you don't have the same credit, you might consolidate. And you know, the $44,000 balance, you can't get PSLF credit, unfortunately, if you're not directly employed by the 501c3 government employer, because you're probably not prohibited from being an athletic trainer directly for the system you work at by state law. It's probably not a direct prohibition. So unfortunately, you probably can't get that. What are the options elsewhere? You know, I would save for retirement. So a lot of people, you know, so most people, typical middle-class family is going to be in a 22% or 24% marginal tax bracket, which means every extra $1,000 you earn next, you're going to be paying about 22 or 24% federal in tax. State, most people pay 5 or 6% for state. So you're about 30% all in for federal and state. And then you're at probably 10% for your student loan payment. So you're basically at a 40% marginal bracket, which is really huge for a family making 160K total, 80K each. So what you could do is max out your 403B or your 401K. You could do $22,500 into that this year. Maybe, let's say you have a spouse who doesn't have loans. Maybe you have the spouse do 4% of their income, and then you do the $22,500. What that does is, remember I said you're paying 10% on $25K in this case? So you'd basically be paying 10% on only $2,500 in this case. So that's $250 a year, about $20 a month. So imagine paying $20 a month with save. There's no interest accrual. So your total interest is just the amount of your monthly payments. That's about $250 of interest a year. That's like a 0.5% interest rate, if I'm doing that math right off the top of my head. Who would not run, not walk to get a 0.5% interest rate? That's pretty amazing, right? Especially because you're growing wealth while you're doing it. So this is really why a lot of this sort of debt ranting, anti-debt, live on rice and beans type advice is just so wrong these days, because there's all this planning opportunity that you can do to avoid having to make those $450 a month payments that you need to pay if you're trying to get rid of it with the standard plan. And if you have a family, two people making 80K each, couple kids, $450 a month, you know, it's not daycare in New York, but it might be daycare in the Midwest. It's a big car payment, basically, right? It's a huge deal. It's a major impact on this person's family if they can get a lower payment. So now on to the next one.
Hi, I have a question regarding the new SAVE plan that was introduced recently. I've done a lot of research and learned as much as I can, and I feel like I have a pretty good handle on most of it. But there's one piece that I don't have clarity on, and I'm hoping that you can help with that, and it's the forgiveness piece. So as I understand it, loans that had an original principal balance of less than $12,000 are eligible for forgiveness after 10 years of qualifying payments and an additional year for every $1,000 beyond that $12,000 threshold. That much I understand. The piece that I cannot seem to find clarity on anywhere is whether that $12,000 threshold is referring to individual loan balances or cumulative. My wife has some student debt that we're working on knocking down, and her debt is made up of 8 smaller loans, each of which fall under that $12,000 threshold for their original principal balances. But if you cumulatively combine all of those principal balances, it exceeds the $12,000. So what I'm not clear on is whether the $12,000 is referring to cumulative, the original principal balance of all of the loans combined, or individually per loan. Part of the reason that I have confusion on this is because I qualified for loan forgiveness through PSLF about a year ago. And when I received forgiveness, it was not a cumulative forgiveness all at one time. It was individualized per loan. So one day I saw one of my loans dropped to zero. A couple weeks later, another 2 of them dropped to zero, but the rest were still there. And then a week later, 2 more dropped to zero. So it appeared that my forgiveness was distributed on an individual basis, loan by loan. And that's why I'm not entirely sure if this $12,000 threshold under the SAVE plan is referring to individual loans or the cumulative. So hopefully that question makes sense. Hopefully you can provide some insight. I'd be so appreciative of that. Thanks so much for your time.
Clearly, this person's done a lot of research. It is a total amount of loans, right? It's 12K total. It's not per loan. So, I mean, otherwise, that'd be pretty doggone amazing, right? I mean, if it was 12K per loan, a whole lot of people will take out kind of small loans across a much larger balance. So why did they say 12K, by the way? 12K is basically the amount for community college that most people borrow. And so the idea, you know, if you think about what are priorities of President Biden, obviously the First Lady, Dr. Jill Biden, is a community college professor, huge proponent of community college. And so, you know, this is essentially their way of trying to make community college free by doing a 10-year timeline, super aggressive, 225% of the poverty line with, you know, 5% of your income for undergrad, which would be community college. I mean, your typical, probably 90, 95% of community college borrowers under SAVE would be able to pay zero. And so you pay zero for just 10 years and, you know, you get rid of it. That's what kind of the aim here is. The reason why this borrower got forgiveness on an individual basis for each loan is because they weren't consolidated. And, you know, PSLF is 10 years on a particular loan amount. You know, usually the way it works is you've got to get 10 years on a loan. So if you might have gotten PSLF or close to getting PSLF on one set of loans, you take out some new loans for a new graduate program, well, now you got to go get 10 more years in those loans to get forgiveness, right? So one of the big opportunities during that PSLF and IDR waivers has been being able to consolidate those types of loans and get the oldest loan credited on the whole thing if you consolidate. What's going to happen after the IDR waiver is over is it's going to be weighted average. So that's going to be a lot less generous because what happens a lot of times is people's oldest loans are undergrad loans with really small balances. And then they go back for school after working a little bit and take out huge loans for grad school. So some of the most shocking, massive savings we get for clients during this IDR waiver period are when, you know, you have one of these scenarios where you've got like a $3,000 loan that was from, you know, 2005 and worked for 10 years. You went back to school, got $200K of debt to get some sort of doctorate or professional degree, and you just consolidate and the whole thing's done. That's just an example. I'll say, though, that a lot of times people get in the weeds on student loans and maybe people enjoy it. And so they try to learn it all because they enjoy it or they need to save money and they're trying to not spend money on unnecessary things. And people might feel like, you know, loan help is something that's not necessary. You know, that's true. It's not necessary. You're not going to, you know, nothing terrible is going to happen to you if you don't get a loan consult. But I'll just say almost always there's something people are missing. So just be aware of that. You've got to feel really confident that you're not missing anything. One of the jokes one of our new consultants said is they basically locked themselves in their apartment for the past month and did nothing but study loan rules. It's very complicated right now in particular. So let's listen to the next one.
Hi, I'm a graduate student, graduate pharmacy student who's graduating in May of 2024, and I'm sort of starting to navigate the world of repayment. And so I came across the new SAVE plan as everyone's been raving about. And I just wanted to know whether we active students who are graduating in less than a year are eligible to apply for the SAVE plan whilst in school, or is that something that's just automatically done? Because I was on the website. I don't see any issues with applying. I mean, I see that it's letting me apply even though it knows the status of my loans, which are in forbearance until obviously graduation. And so that's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
So there's a really cool loophole that people are not aware of where grad plus loans are able to be entered into repayment 60 days after disbursement, I believe. And Stafford unsubsidized loans are required to stay in deferment the entire time you're in school. So the opportunity is essentially to get your grad school loans out of this in-school deferment by you can call your servicer, you can submit an in-school deferment waiver form, and you can also just try to go online and apply for it and see what happens. And what's going to happen is 60 days after disbursement, any of your grad loans would get onto the SAVE plan. And if since you're a student, if you've been filing taxes showing a $0 income, you could get a $0 payment. All of your interest in your grad plus loans could be subsidized. So this is a really big opportunity. This does not apply to staffer loans or parent plus loans. The thought process here is, why don't more people do this? It's going to be a big pain in the butt to keep them in repayment. So what happens is every time your school reports your enrollment status, it kicks your loans back into deferment. Just automatically. And so somebody that does this would have to be constantly checking their loans, calling their servicer, making sure that their loans are continually being placed in a save plan, like every semester at least. And again, only Grad Plus loans can go into this plan. And then when you graduate, you would probably consolidate everything together. And at that point in 2024, it'll be the weighted average that would be applied to the new loan. So you'd probably get an extra year towards forgiveness if you're doing a 20-year plan or 25-year plan by doing this. And then if you are going for PSLF, it actually doesn't really help you, this strategy, because PSLF is, you know, unlimited forgiveness. And then, you know, PSLF, you have to be working at a nonprofit employer to get a year of credit. So this is really something that I think, you know, pharmacy, a lot of people work in private sector in pharmacy, law, vet med, dental, that's the primary application of this, maybe physical therapy as well. Physicians, it's a little bit less important because most people would be going for PSLF these days. If you were a private practice physician or expecting to be, then this would be a pretty valuable thing to at least attempt if you, you know, if you read about financial stuff, if you don't mind listening, you listen to podcasts like this, you're probably a financial oriented person. So, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea to at least give it a shot. There's no reason why you wouldn't try this. Now for the next one.
Hi, I have a very specific question, and my question is regarding Parent Plus loans that my ex and I, well, my soon-to-be ex and I, took out in probably the amount of about $90,000. Our kids are graduated by now and have their own student loans to pay back. So though those parent loans are all in my soon-to-be ex's name, he contends that that is marital asset and it is marital debt, and that we both need to pay that back. So what he is proposing is that he writes a check to me in the amount of $45,000, and then I can handle it in any way, shape, or form that I like. The Parent Plus loans have just been sitting there throughout COVID, and we have not, or he has not done any form of consolidation. So my question, I guess, is two-pronged. A, is the double consolidation loophole the best way to get the Parent Plus loans in shape for the future repayment? And B, would I be smart or not smart to accept his proposal of a cash offer to me for $45,000, after which he would like to put the Parent Plus loans in my name and he will have nothing to do with? So A, do we use the double consolidation loophole to get those in shape? And then B, would it be smart for me to allow him to put the whole debt in my name, take the $45,000 and repay it in some fashion on my own? Thank you.
I think I disagree with what's being proposed here in a lot of levels. Parent Plus debt is in the name of a person and it is their debt. The only way to get their name off of it is to refinance it into the private system. That is the only way to do it. The person that has the debt would be have to be the one to do a double consolidation. There's no way to transfer it. And so effectively, if this $90K of debt would have to become yours, you'd have to refinance it into a private loan. You'd get $45K to pay it off. And suddenly you've got to pay back $45K with interest. So this is a very inequitable proposal here. The other thing to think about is, so let me put this disclaimer in here. I'm not an attorney. You have to, you know, consult a licensed attorney for legal advice. But here's my opinion. If you do some Google searching, in general, debt is not an asset. It's not community assets. It's not. It's in the person's name. That's probably why this person's proposing this, is because they've probably done some research. And everybody going through something that people don't want to, obviously nobody wants to go through it, but that are going through it, is probably going to be looking for the best option for them. And to me, this is not a great proposal. I will say this, if you're both trying to get towards a thing that is fair, I will say I've seen some pretty reasonable approaches to Parent Plus loans in a divorce. I mean, one of the cases that really jumped out at me was, I remember a case where somebody had like $300K of Parent Plus loans. They were a lower income person. They had a higher income person that the court ruled them to split that $300K down the middle. And that was a terrible approach for both of them, because essentially it was totally forgivable as a Parent Plus debt. It was totally forgivable. The person had a low income. Their payments would have been a couple hundred a month. The thing that made a lot more sense is just for, frankly, an additional amount of alimony below the level of the monthly payments as to what they would have been. It was a better, it was better for both of the parties involved. And so this judge clearly didn't understand student loan debt, because the judge was the one that ruled it. So I would just say be very cognizant, and I'll say this is to everyone in general, if you, you know, think at some point there's a chance you get divorced, you should know that assets are split 50-50, but debt is not. So if you have, you know, if you're the spouse with the debt, get as much prepayment on your loans as possible, because that debt is not split 50-50. You would keep all of it in the event of divorce in most cases. And then, you know, if your spouse has debt and you think there's a possibility you might one day be an ex-spouse, then you'd want to not make payments into that, because you're paying down something that would only be with them anyway in the event of a split. So a little fun fact to know. Now let's listen to the next one.
Hey guys, my name's Emily. You are amazing. And if you are listening, these guys are amazing. They have transformed my life and have created an incredible amount of control in my life, which if you understood how little bit of money I have, you would be surprised. I have $290,000+ in loans, and I pay $0 a month every month. And that was before the COVID pause. Now, coming out of the COVID pause, I also happen to be divorced now. I had been on IBR in order to keep my payment at zero because my wife had a high income. But now I don't know if I should be trying to stay on IBR or not, or go to the save plan. So that's question one, is do I try to stay on the IBR plan? And question two, trying to verify my work eligibility. The school district I work for, who fired me, had filled out my eligibility paperwork and said that I was a current employee and that I was like working currently and everything. And that was back in June of 2023. And now it's August. And so I don't know if I can file that right now while I'm filing for unemployment and not raise some red flags, because I don't want to get in trouble with the government or anything else. So hopefully that made sense. So love you guys and hope that makes sense.
So this listener probably needs to go to the save plan, but the thing that matters is the timing. So if your payment is $0 a month, it's likely, you know, that that could last until 2024, or even 2025. You have to look at your NSLDS file or your servicer. You could call a servicer, but that's a long hold time. So the NSLDS file is the easiest way to figure this out. If you just download that TXT file and then just Control F anniversary, you'll find your anniversary date for IDR and then basically add a year to whatever you find in most cases. So let's say this person's recertification date is August 2023 and their NSLDS file, you would know that you could keep $0 a month until August of 2024. If this person's divorced, then let's say they're filing single, then probably the best option is going to be the save plan. It gets interest subsidies. It's 10% of income instead of 15% with IBR. Old IBR, at least, that's a pretty good deal. In terms of the question about PSLF, how to do that, I mean, in general, we always just recommend people be above board, right? And just whatever, you know, your situation is, you submit for it, get it certified, the end, right? If they called you a current employee on the form that you recently submitted, and let's say that you realize, oh no, I got like given credit that I wasn't supposed to get, you could always make an argument if somebody ever raised the question that you were maybe on a 12-month contract, you have summers off, you're technically an employee in the summers. You know, I don't know. I mean, like, you know, don't lose sleep over this. It's not the kind of thing where you made a mistake on your taxes and you have to correct it. You know, I don't even know if they have a process to undo a PSLF certification form that was filed incorrectly. I would just continue just moving forward. Just go ahead and fill out everything the right way and let them determine it, right? That's probably what I would do, is just recommend this person not lose any sleep over this. So let's listen to another one.
Hi, student loan planner team. I am getting ready for my repayments under the SAVE plan, and I am wondering, is there any benefit in making additional monthly payments while on the SAVE plan, or is it best for me to put this additional money into other areas such as a mortgage and retirement? Thanks for the advice.
So we expect the SAVE plan is going to work the same way that the repay plan did. And the way that plan worked is, if you're getting interest subsidies, you get the interest subsidies calculated whenever that new IDR, you know, monthly payment is calculated. And then if you want to pay extra on top of that, you can, and it would all go towards any accrued interest balance if you have any first, and then it would go towards the principal. So I'll give you an example. So let's say you've got a $100,000 loan amount. Let's say you have 6% interest. So your total interest every year is $6,000. It's $500 a month, right? Let's say that your save payment is $200 a month. So the way that save plan works is anything above $200 a month, in this case, that'd be $300, would be fully subsidized by the government. So effectively, you're getting a $300 interest subsidy every month for the next 12 months until you have to recertify next, and then that interest subsidy is recalculated. So what you could do, let's say you get a $10,000 bonus, so you know you're going to pay off your loans. You could take that $10,000 and dump it into your loans. If there's any accrued interest balance, it's got to go to that first. Now, a lot of people get real freaked out about that, or, you know, worried about that. Don't worry about it at all. It's not a big deal. It's still going towards, you know, your balance. People think it's not going towards principal, but it really is, because you do owe it. So don't freak out about that. The $10,000 would go into paying down that balance with whatever your total balance is. And then let's say you've got $90,000 now and it's time to recertify next year, and let's say your payment is $500 a month because your income went up a bunch on the save plan. Well, in this case, because you paid on the balance, the total interest every year is no longer $6,000 a year. It's a little bit less than that. So that means $500 a month would not only fully cover your interest, but it would also pay down some of the principal balance. So now you have no more interest subsidy on save. Your interest rate is actually 6%. And now if you're needing to pay off the loan, you would look at refinancing options versus just keeping it federal. Now, let's say this person checks refi rates and finds a 5.5% rate for private. That's not that big of a difference to me. I would keep it federal, right? Now, let's say if you have an 8% rate and you find 5.5, to me, anything better than 1% lower is like worth it. If you're just rock solid finances, no chance you're going to go PSLF, you've looked into it, there's no way you could get 20 or 25 year forgiveness, then go ahead and take it to private sector and just get the lowest interest rate you can and follow that refi ladder strategy, which is where you start off with a longer term loan, pay it down with prepayments whenever you get extra money, refi it again to a 10-year, pay down extra money, refi it again to a 5-year. What I would expect is, like, you know, we'll see lower interest rates. The Federal Reserve will probably lower rates the next recession we have, or when inflation calms down, and then we'll be able to get better rates for like shorter term refis right now. But right now, the only really valuable refi out there is like a 15 or 20 year refi, I think, for the most part, because otherwise you're committing to a high interest rate with a fixed payment with a short term, and that's not a good idea. Now on to the next one.
Hey, Travis, I heard there has been a few modifications to the ECFR 685.219 Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. I was wondering whether PSLF eligible borrowers must stay employed by the PSLF eligible employer until the loans are completely forgiven. I have been informed by a few sources that you are allowed to leave the PSLF eligible employer once you send in your final ECF. Just wanted to see if this is true. Thank you.
So to be honest, I have to double check this one myself. I'm going to get through some of the regulations to see if I can get an answer on this one. But the issue, the reason why it's complicated is because the PSLF waiver waived this rule, so you no longer had to be at a qualifying employer to get forgiveness. And then the IDR waiver, that was one of the only provisions of the IDR waiver that they did not include in the IDR waiver. And so we had somebody that we could not figure out why she was not getting forgiveness. And then we realized it's because she had a lot of forbearance and she needed the IDR waiver to take place to get to 120. And she was at more than 120, but she was not at a qualifying employer anymore. And that's why they hadn't discharged it. And then now there's new regulations that just went into effect July 1. This is one I should really know, but sometimes it stumps me and I have to go double check to make sure I don't give out incorrect information. So I'll get back to y'all on this one in a future podcast episode. I know it's obviously quite important. So most people luckily are at a qualifying employer when they get forgiveness just because they like the job, they like staying there. But some people are looking for an opportunity to either reduce their hours to go part-time or to switch to a private employer where you can earn a lot more money for the time that you're putting in at work. So I'll double check and get back to you on that one. Let's listen to another one.
Hi, I have super old loans. I started college in 1999, and so I have old loans under that FFEL program. I then changed careers in 2009. I went back to school for grad school, and now I have a big loan balance. I'm currently in the old IBR, and I've made payments in that since 2013. So I'm wondering if I consolidate and get in the SAVE program, are all of these 10 years of payments going to count, or am I wasting my money? Thanks. Bye.
This person needs to hurry up and consolidate absolutely everything ASAP, because this loan from 99 could get credited towards the entire balance that she's got from the more recent graduate loans. And, you know, if all things work out well, if you've been in repayment or forbearance of some kind since 99, the only thing you wouldn't get credit for would be in-school deferment, probably when you were borrowing for grad school in that interim period. So let's say you're in a grad school program for, you know, 3 years, and you've been in repayment or forbearance or deferment since 99. Basically, that's 24 years minus 3 or 4 years for grad school. That's 20 years towards forgiveness. You might need 5 more years. So this is literally showing the massive impact of the IDR waiver. A lot of times people get scared because they've heard that if you consolidate, you wipe away your credit. That's normally true. That's not true right now. It's the opposite. And then, you know, what's going to happen in December 31st is it's going to be weighted average, which is somewhere in between wiping everything away and getting loans credited with the loan with the oldest max count. So yeah, hurry up and go to studentaid.gov and consolidate. We have a little redirect link because the website is kind of weird. So studentloanplanner.com/consolidate will take you to the right place if you want a shorter URL to remember. Let's listen to the next one.
Hello, I am trying to figure out what to do with my student loans as they come due here fairly soon. I am currently on the IBR plan, or the income-based repayment plan, and I'm considering the new SAVE plan. I was wondering if you switch from, say, the IBR plan to the SAVE plan, if you are easily able to switch back to, say, the income-based repayment plan or another income-driven plan if something were to happen to this new SAVE plan in the future. Also, as I was looking at the studentaid.gov website, there's a section here that says end of interest capitalization when a borrower leaves most IDR plans. And it says as of July 1st, 2023, unpaid interest on your loans won't be added to your principal when you leave any IDR plan except the income-based repayment plan where capitalization is required by statute. I do not understand what that is saying. If I switch from IBR to the SAVE plan, am I going to have some sort of capitalization on the interest to do that switch? If you could explain that for me, and also regarding my previous question about going back and forth between different plans, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
What that means is basically Department of Ed wanted to do as much as they possibly could do for people unless the law like explicitly prohibited them from doing something. So in this particular case, the income-based repayment plan, when you leave that plan and enter another plan, it literally requires in the law, clear as day, that you have to capitalize the interest. What that means is, let's say you were accruing interest in grad school, that balance is added to an accrued interest bucket instead of the principal bucket. And then when you exit repayment, it used to always be that everything capitalized and, you know, you had a new principal balance based off of that total amount. Now we think that's going to happen only basically by consolidating or leaving the IBR plan. So you might say, is that bad? That sounds so terrible. Capitalizing, it's that kind of almost sounds like capital punishment, right? I mean, it's like that's what kind of maybe some people's minds would jump to. It's not that at all. Because of the SAVE plan, if your income's low, you get interest subsidies, right? So if your interest subsidy, you know, if you have an income that results in interest subsidies, what matters is your effective rate. And the only thing you know, interest accrual, the interest accrued interest bucket impacts is just what is your effective interest rate. That's the only thing that it matters for. So if you can get a really low effective interest rate by the save plan, capitalizing your interest is no big deal at all. I will say that one of the big things people will mess up on is getting off the IBR plan if their payment's really low, because maybe you recertified and using a 2018 tax return that showed you making $30K for 3 months that you, after you graduated your program. I'm just throwing out a hypothetical here. And your payment's like $100 a month, and now you're making $250 as, you know, corporate counsel somewhere, and your, you know, your payments would be $2,000 a month, or, you know, $1,500 a month or something like that if you switch to save, and you can still go for forgiveness or something like that. I'm just throwing out some hypothetical numbers here. So in that case, you could cost yourself tons of money by applying for the save plan, because what's going to happen is they're going to ask you for that most recent tax return if you switch. So this is a hazard, big hazard. It's why kind of I think that there's not a lot of downside to people who are on like a pay or an IBR just to wait until 2024, deep breaths and like sort of wait to switch to the save plan just to make sure, one, that you're not recertifying early with a much higher income, and two, just to let the dust settle a little bit. They just threw out tons of regulations and servicers are going to be swamped. And it's going to be a big mess, and it might be kind of good for some people to just wait. Now, the downside to waiting is the IDR waiver going away. That'd be a disaster for certain people that could be benefiting from that. In terms of being able to get back onto the IBR plan, so the SAVE plan has a rule in it that basically says if you are on this plan for more than 5 years between 2024, July 2024 and after, then you can't switch on to anything else. So what that means is, you know, say you're on it as of July 2024, the first date that you're locked into the SAVE plan forever is July 2029. Now, the pay plan goes away in July of 2024 for people that are trying to get new access to it. So if you're already on the pay-as-you-earn plan, you can keep it after that date. But anybody who wants to sign up for it on a new basis after July 2024 cannot. And so the people that don't have to really worry about that at all are people that are new borrowers as of July 2014 that had no balance of student loans before that date. Because in that case, you qualify for new IBR, which means that if you're a new borrower as of July 2014, then you have access to essentially what's the same thing as the pay plan, pretty much. New IBR is basically the same thing as the pay plan. And you have access to that all the way up until July of 2029. So what are some of the catches, or what are the, some of the things that I'm worried about? There is a possibility that, let's say you have a Republican win in 2028, and they wait until nobody can switch out of the SAVE plan, and then they redo the regulations and switch everybody back onto the repay plan, and no longer people have the ability to file taxes separately. You know, that's a possibility. I'm not saying it's a probability. I mean, certainly, you know, Republicans want to win elections too, and they are going to do things that appeal to voters, and especially like highly educated voters disproportionately in the suburbs of swing states, right? Like, so you're going to try to, you know, modulate your positions to appeal to the audience you need to. So I'm not necessarily saying they would do that, but it's something to think about. I mean, there is some benefit to being in a plan like pay that was sort of forgotten about and left behind, because it probably means that people aren't going to mess with it. The SAVE plan, I mean, it's extremely generous. It's extremely opposed by Republicans. It's a big, obvious issue now that people will pay attention to on the GOP side of things. And, just to let you guys know this, like a GOP congressperson on the education committee literally called into the negotiated rulemaking committee while they were making these new rules and said essentially like a throwdown. He was like, don't make these rules too aggressive, or the next time we're in charge, we're just going to undo everything you did and go farther. I'll talk about that in a podcast episode in the future. I don't want to just create worry to just create worry, but it's a possibility. It's not necessarily a probability, right? But there are some benefits to using a plan like pay that's going to get left behind, or especially new IBR that's in the statute that can't be modified without 60 votes in the Senate. But that said, SAVE plan, if you're getting benefits from it, nobody's taking those benefits away while you're on it. So if you can get benefits from it, absolutely do the SAVE plan, benefit all you can from it. There's no harm in that, no bad idea in that at all. So let's do another one next.
I had a question. If we amended our tax return for the year 2022 from married filing joint to married filing single, would they accept that on an income-driven plan?
So we'll just make this the last question. You cannot amend from joint to separate. You can only amend from separate to joint. What that usually means is you file separate, and that helps you. Great, use it. Sometimes you can get a lot of money back if you amend from separate to joint. And the most common case we apply this in is PSLF, where somebody has a final 3 or 4 years that they're trying to get the minimum payments, but they have a big tax hit from separate. So you do separate for a few years, and then you go and amend it at the end. You can do that 3 years in the past. So you can amend a bunch of returns all at once with 1040X, but you cannot go from joint to separate. What we would suggest instead is that you take advantage of the on-ramp forbearance, which is something that it's probably best achieved by just calling your servicer and asking for forbearance. I would really suggest this to anybody whose payment would go down next year compared to what it is right now. So that's most commonly people who filed joint that should have filed separate, and people who have only undergrad loans that could pay 5% of income on save versus 10, because that regulation doesn't go into effect until July 2024. So if you need to do that, then I would just go into that forbearance status and then file your, once you get your tax return in correctly, you can go recertify your income again and get a lower payment. And that question is a very minorly complex question compared to a lot of the stuff we get with taxes. And so that's one of the reasons why we have decided to get into the tax preparation business, because of just how many people would use a CPA or a tax person and would have no clue what we were talking about when we said to file separately or to file Form 8958 or split the income or, you know, whatever, you know, amending the returns. I mean, you know, the tax folks just look at folks just like you got five eyes or something like that, right? And so we are going to only offer that service to folks who are also clients of SLP Wealth. And we will talk more about that in some future podcast episodes. So just know that that's coming down the pipeline. But if you have a rapidly increasing income, if you live in one of the 9 community property states, if you have concerns about married filing separately and how it affects your ability to do a Roth IRA or the dependent child tax credit or the capital loss deduction, you know, we are going to be able to give really expert level help on that pretty soon. I'm excited to share. So for now, that is a lot of questions. It's a little bit longer episode than we usually do. I apologize that we had so many to get through today. Obviously, there's a whole lot of questions with repayment going on, right? So if you have a question or a comment about what's going on with student loan repayment, about stuff that you're seeing, we'd love to hear it. So go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and you can just use your phone to just talk into that phone and leave a quick message as to what you're seeing or questions you have about what your repayment should be. We'd love to feature some more listener questions on a future pod episode. So studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And then, of course, if you need a student loan plan, book now, because you need to book now or almost forever hold your peace. It's kind of getting to that point because we're running up on the end of the year. We do have a limited capacity despite tripling the size of our consultant team. And so we want as many people as possible to get the IDR waiver benefits that we can humanly help. And so we would suggest you go to studentloanplanner.com/book to get on our calendar for that. A lot of these questions show the complexity of student loans. It's hard. It's dumb. Shouldn't be this hard, but it is. And we'd love to kind of put that loan burden behind you. Or if you're an existing client, we can refresh your plan. A lot of people haven't talked to us since the pandemic, and there's a whole bunch of changes that have happened. So it'd be good to get a refresher if you need one of those. And of course, if you're a client of SLP Wealth, just reach out to your advisor. That's included. You can kind of do a refresher on your plan if you need one. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your week.